Four Midwest Guys presents... Top 5 Movies of the 21st Century.
And why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No. No, you. You complete me.
There is an epidemic failure within the game to understand what is really happening.
It was a boy? And you fell in love with a boy?
Yes, I did. Very much so.
That's silly.
You're right. It was silly. It was very, very silly.
There's another word for it.
It's like in the great stories, Mr. Fertile. The ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end.
What do these movies all have in common is that they are on one, or maybe even both, or more, of our, well, the four Midwest guys picked for our Desert Island all-time top five best films of the past 15 years or both.
And welcome to Four Midwest Guys Presents, the top five movies of the 21st century. I'm your host tonight, B. Willie. With me is Brian Eckenbauer. Brian, how
What's
are
up?
You?
I'm good.
And Brian B., how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you?
And Mr. John Z, Dirty John Z.
How's it going? And we are bringing you our picks for the top five films of the past 15 years, because it's crucial to note that as times progress, trends in filmmaking change, and it's important to see what movies left an impact and what movies were just simply flashes in the pan. We're ignoring the flashes in the pan and going to focus on the movies that left an impact on us. And we'll start it over with Hershey's pick for number five.
Okay, so my pick for number five, I will preface this, though. I did have a hard time coming up with a list of films. but there have been a number of films that have impacted me, I guess you could say, over the past 15 years. So my number five pick my top five movie of the past 15 years would be Michael Mann's Collateral. Came out in 2004, stars Jamie Foxx as well as Tom Cruise. Both of their performances were widely praised, and Foxx being nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for this movie. A neo-noir crime thriller, as I mentioned, directed by Michael Mann, written by Stuart Beattie. This is kind of a bookend to Michael Mann's 1995 film Heat, which had a pretty stellar cast in it as well. Stars Tom Cruise as Vincent, who exits a building after actually getting an exchange at the airport, and just basically kind of chronicles his killing spree across Los Angeles over a weekend. Very gripping movie, in my opinion. A lot of good performances in this. I've actually kind of grown accustomed to a lot of Michael Mann's films over the years. He's actually got a very good directing style. Has a lot of use of light and darkness in his films, which is kind of one of the things that partially attracted me to this movie, aside from the fact it's a Michael Mann film. So, I mean, the majority of Michael Mann films, you can't go wrong with those. So it left a lasting impression on me.
What was your opinion of Cruise's performance?
I will honestly say that I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan, but... This performance of him in Collateral, I thought, was very, very different, a very different role for Cruise to play, because he's portrayed as the bad guy. And a lot of the things that you see Tom Cruise in over the years have been him portraying the good guy, similar to like a Robin Williams kind of doing a turn of play, whereas a lot of the stuff you see Robin Williams in is kind of more happy-go-lucky, and then, you know, Robin Williams having the turn in one-hour photo playing a bad guy. So this is kind of that same whole premise of Cruise playing the bad guy, which is not something you see very often.
Did you have a hard time getting past that since he's played such other various roles over the years?
No, I don't think so. Like I said, the thing that really attracted me to this movie was the fact that it was Michael Mann directing it. And Michael Mann has, like I said, he's had a long tenure in Hollywood. A lot of his movies have a very, very effective use of lighting. He's had a lot of different camera operators, cinematographers working with him as well.
What was your take on him, like, of his recent stuff, like the last few movies he's done?
well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, I didn't get the chance to see Ali, although I heard mixed reviews about that, and I didn't see Miami Vice either. So,
because I saw Miami Vice, Public Enemies, and Ali, and I'll leave it at that. They didn't quite live up to Heat and The Insider.
Yeah, I can agree with you on that.
Got it. As,
The one thing I will like to preface as far as like Tom Cruise, honestly, I love him because I think he's the closest America is ever going to get to Jackie Chan, because that is a man who, as we've seen in the last couple Mission Impossible movies, he will put his entire self at risk to do the most insane stunts just as long as the audience is entertained. So the guy is a born entertainer. He will go all out.
Even if he is batshit crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean off camera, God knows how crazy he is. When he's in front of the camera, if he could give everybody popcorn, he would.
I agree.
All right. Well, I think that brings up to my number five pick, and I picked number five. My number five pick was Serenity.
Nice choice.
Thank you.
All the brown coats out there love you.
Yes. This is the nerd pick. Many nerd picks, actually, but yeah, I love this movie. This is for those of you who don't know out there, Serenity is the movie that kind of ends the Firefly series. Should have continued, in my opinion. It's kind of Josh Whedon's attempt at making a Star Wars movie, in my opinion. Very well done. I'm not going to give my opinions are going to be very technical based, but this is just a pure love nerd love fest on this movie for me. Pick for me. Because of the Firefly connection, but it stands alone by itself. You don't have to watch Firefly in order to watch this movie either. It stands alone by itself as well. In fact, I actually did it in reverse. I saw Serenity, and then I went back and watched Firefly.
Same here. Yeah.
I was actually planning on doing the same thing. Every time Serenity's on TV, which it seems to be on quite a bit now, I watch it every time it's on.
Right. Same here. Yeah, it's just. I saw it the first time at the theater. I was like, hey, this is pretty fun, but I never saw the show. But now that I've seen the show and I'm just love the show, I'm like you. I want to go back and just watch the movie again from point A to point B and just really appreciate it for what it is. Especially that opening shot is phenomenal. It's a giant one take through the entire ship, and it's so beautifully done.
Yeah, and just the action sequence with the, what do they call it, Reavers?
Reavers.
Yeah, just amazing. It's down, it's dirty, it's gritty, it's that definitely the used universe taken to the extreme, even beyond Star Wars used universe. So just a really good movie, in my opinion. It definitely made I made it my top five pick. So, John, I think
it's Brian's time, the other Brian, Ankenbauer.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I was looking at the number four. So go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. I went with Christopher Nolan's Inception as my number five. Much like you, Brian, my picks are all movies that stuck with me, not for technical reasons, but just for enjoyment of the films. I think DiCaprio in this movie was phenomenal. Gordon Love Hewitt was awesome too.
Yeah, definitely.
This movie, it really felt like you were living the dreams that these people were living.
Yeah, even Ellen Page, I thought, did a really good job in that movie. Just she was just a supporting role. So.
You guys want to do like a technical analysis for it too, I adored every bit of craft that movie put together from the scope of the effects to the brilliant use of cinematography, the reliance on special effects over visual effects, that Nolan used as much on-set effects as he could before having to rely on CG, and it's that hallway fight is still one of the best constructed fight scenes in recent years. It's just, it is a technically brilliant film. It is a wonderful film to watch and just enjoy the ride and try to figure out, map the figuring out which level of dream you're in that you're watching at the time. It's a fantastic movie, and I remember when I went to see it, my wife just got through doing her NCLEX test, which is like, it's basically like the MCATs for nurses, and she got out of it, she like emptied out about several months of knowledge, and she went, okay, what are we seeing? It's like, hey, I'm taking you to see Inception. She came out of it, and her brain hurt. Like, she went straight to the car and grabbed, like, ibuprofen. So, I mean, as I said, under the right circumstances, I have tortured people with Chris Nolan movies.
I would say this is definitely not a movie you want to watch on LSD, because you will freak out about it. So, Bertie, what do you think on this one, pal?
On Inception?
Yeah.
I can honestly say, you guys will probably shoot me for this, but I've not seen it yet.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And, no, I have no reason to shoot someone for not seeing something.
Well, no, it's not because I didn't want to see it. It's just I wanted to see it, but I just never had the opportunity to.
I own it on Blu-ray if you want to borrow it.
I've got the Blu-ray, too, with the script, yes.
But I did want to interject a previous comment about Josh Whedon and Serenity. Now, I can honestly say I tried watching Firefly, tried to get into it, and I could not make it past like the first two or three episodes.
That's the problem. Once you get past those, that's where the real meat and potatoes of the show come in.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. It's like, if you look, aside from the Avengers and Avengers Age of Ultron, and aside from Cabin in the Woods, what is Josh Whedon mostly known for? He's mostly known for television rather than he is for movies.
And also getting an Oscar nomination for writing the first script for Toy Story.
That's true. But if you look at his track record, aside from the Avengers movies, his track record has been better represented in the television realm than it has been in the movie realm.
Well, I'll give you that. Yeah, he has more experience in the TV realm currently. I mean, I would love if they gave Josh Whedon one of the Star Wars standalone film.
That'd be a good pick.
Yeah, in my opinion. I'd have all the faith in the world with him, with a guy like that. So,
He did Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Exactly, right? And that's right. Of course, it's real campy and stuff, but still.
Buffy managed to actually be a very good dramatic film on its own, or dramatic series on its own. There are some episodes, like the Hush episode is one of the best written and directed TV episodes of the time when it came out. It's incredibly inventive. All right, so going on to number five of my list, I actually have a tie because I labored long and hard to try to figure out which action movie stood out, and I figured why not include both of them to show how dynamic they are. And my choice is a tie between Sam Mendes' Skyfall, which is the third entry of the Daniel Craig Bond films, and I've actually heard people that have come out of that movie. One of my friends actually remarked that he has outmanned Michael Mann with the Shanghai fight scene in the tower. And it is one of the most gorgeously, gorgeously shot movies I have ever seen in my life. It is beyond intricately constructed in its action scenes. The setup to each of them is pitch perfect. The photography.
Beyond the Matrix?
I don't even mention the picture. But where was I? But yeah, just with Skyfall, it was one of those movies I was glad I got to see on the big screen when I did, because every frame of that movie utilized what it meant to see something on the big screen. And Roger Deakins, with the film, again, proves that he is one of the greatest living and one of the greatest all-time cinematographers. It's just perfect. I mean, they're from the moment of Shanghai to that final battle at the end, the shootout at the house and the moors was just so fantastic. But tying that list, going from the very, very pristine, very classy, very polished look of Skyfall, I have the very current film, Mad Max Fury Road, which is very hyperkinetic, very intense, very nonstop action, and, again, one of the best plotted, laid out, and made action films I've seen in recent years. There's not one moment of that film that didn't have me in awe of its photography, of its stunt coordination, of its shot composition, which again, and I have to note this, the director and the DP are either in their 60s and 70s, and they have proven they have more machismo than any other action director working today with this one film, and oh god, I love it. If anything else wins the stunt ensemble over this movie, it's going to be a crime.
John, I just recently saw that with you. It was definitely a phenomenal movie, but I think the best way to describe that movie was when you know, the question was asked by your wife, why is that? And your response was, because, fuck yeah.
I believe I know the scene. It's the favorite moment of the flamethrower guitar player. You pan up and there's the guy just on his bungee cords playing the chords, and all of a sudden fire starts shooting out of the guitar, and just like everybody in the theater is just like having an orgasmic release right there with them, and it's just, oh, it's beautiful. And then she looks at me, she's like, why? And it was just with Mad Max, there is no why. It's because.
Kind of sounds like Kiss on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a memorable scene, and that movie definitely, like when I go to buy it, that's definitely one of the Blu-rays that I buy for this year's movies. It was definitely intense from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, you guys definitely piqued my interest. I haven't seen Mad Max, but I will say for Skyfall, and I've said this in past shows, I was not a Bond fan. I was just a guy who would go watch Bond movies, but Skyfall made me a Bond fan.
Skyfall's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely worth checking out. Okay, gentlemen, when we're through our number fives, we're on to number fours. And Mr. Rankinbauer, you get to take the lead, sir.
Okay, starting out with my number fours, let's do one that I'm sure a lot of people enjoyed. I don't know if they'll have it on their top list or not, but I'm going to go with the Dark Knight trilogy.
Very well done.
Another Christopher Nolan movie.
I think you've got like his four of his movies in a row, and then your last two.
I know. I was like, okay. But yeah, these movies, it brought Batman to life. Other Batman movies, like the Michael Keaton movie, though it's great in its own right, still felt very on screen, could never happen.
Comic bookish.
Otherworldly.
Yes.
Yeah,
The Dark Knight felt for me like it was like I almost could have been watching the news, and this could have been happening somewhere. It was very, very dark. I felt the villain in each one of the movies was tremendous.
I agree.
I mean, just in the fact that they pulled all of them in, I was really sad, you know, when Heath Ledger died, because just think about where this would have went had he been around to play the Joker in another movie.
Oh, I agree. I've thought about that a lot. I wonder, though, if we would have paid as much attention to the movie.
Yeah,
if he had lived.
I actually heard that the Scarecrow scenes that were in The Dark Knight Rises would have been written just for the Joker.
Wow.
Because that was his world. It's a world with no rules. It's a world of chaos. And I think Dark Knight might actually be higher up on my list. I think this is the first time we've come across a movie that might coincide with another list.
To be continued.
But yeah, going off your note, when I first saw Batman Begins, I immediately connected to it because it was something that felt like it was part of the world we lived in. Like, it didn't feel disconnected, like we didn't have aliens or someone with a superpower. Like, this actually felt like a real-world hero. And I remember being in New York City and coming out and stepping out, and it was like 10:30 at night. I looked up, and the same sepia tone from all the streetlights that was in Batman Begins was out there. I wanted to look around going, man, I wish I had a base jumping suit right now.
You wish you were a billionaire, didn't you?
I did. I did at that moment wish I was a billionaire. Just like I'm wishing I was a billionaire right now.
Yeah, definitely one of the better trilogies of the 21st century, by far. if not maybe the best trilogy so far.
Easily, it's a fantastic one.
I'm sure we'll come across some more as we continue.
Speaking of trilogies,
this moves into my number four pick, and this is the Bourne trilogy. I think when you think, if you've ever seen any of these, this has a very, the chase scenes, the fight scenes, they all have a very, I don't know if the word would be European feel to them, like the style of them. I think the Bourne trilogy is the reason why we got Skyfall and why we got the basically up the game. It changed the genre of the spy film, in my opinion.
It did.
It caused the Bond series to create Skyfall, essentially, and up their game. If you've seen any of these movies, including the fourth installment, which isn't quite as good as the original trilogy, but any of them.
I still like that one, too.
Oh, yeah, I did, too. I'm kind of interested to see where it goes next, where they try to cross those two up.
Is that the new one coming out in 2016, or is that when it starts filming?
I thought this one started filming. I haven't heard anything about it being...
I think it's when they start filming. They're still casting now.
Yeah, they're still casting.
Okay,
So, but yeah, outstanding trilogy. If any kind of spy... If you're into the spy genre at all, this is where, or if you're just looking for a place to start here.
And I gotta say, Bershi, you've discussed in a previous post or stuff about great car chases. Each one of the Bourne movies has the most perfect car chase. Like, whether it's Bourne Supremacy's Russian car chase or the New York City car chase. I mean, I've always said that if I wanted a driving instructor, I want it to be Jason Bourne, just from those scenes alone.
Oh, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Birch, what did you think about the Bourne trilogy?
And again, I'm going to get some flack for this because...
we're going to have to strap you down, buddy.
I've not seen any of the Bourne trilogy movies. I'll be the first to admit as well, I was not a big fan of the Dark Knight trilogy. I saw Batman Begins. I fell asleep in the movie. It was just kind of slow and boring for me. So I didn't waste my time on the other two.
Well, you missed out on the Dark Knight.
Yeah.
No, well.
You did on the Dark Knight. I'll agree. But if you get a chance, you really should sit down and watch the Bourne trilogy. It's fantastic.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. Moving on, John, your number four, sir?
My number four pick is Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I saw this movie when it first came out, and I seriously go back to it ever since. It has probably the best fight scenes I've ever seen in a movie. Over The Matrix, over anything else, over Bourne. I mean, the fight scenes are beautiful, flawless, and... The funny thing to mention is every one of the fight scenes involves either Michelle Yeoh or Zhang Ziyi, and like there's at least one woman in each one of the fight scenes. The movie's got a strong feminist tone to it in a way, and I did a paper on it in my senior English class about how the Western romantic themes of the movie Sense and Sensibility, which Ang Lee also directed in 1995, actually kind of coincide with the journeys the female characters in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon go on with Michelle Yeoh and Ziyi Zhang, because you have the restrained, confined to the ways of the culture that the older one has to go through in Michelle Yeoh and also in Emma Thompson, and the younger aristocrat who wants to embrace the world around her and just take everything in and just explore as much as she can go through. You see that in both Kate Winslet and Ziyi Zhang, whereas with Sense and Sensibility, you get to watch them get married. In Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you get a chance to actually just watch them beat the crap out of an entire bar full of Chinese warlords.
I'll take that over that Sense and Sensibility.
And it manages to be a poetic film, too. Every shot is beautiful. The fight on top of the bamboo trees, it's cinematic gold.
I thought this was like the first modern take on the 21st century take on the Far East mythology, even, you know, the whole mysticism, if you will.
Mm.
But this was the first decent one, you know.
Helped to cross over
into
the
that
Western
was
culture.
One, maybe Mortal Kombat, but that was probably the early 90s. So, I thought that you know, this was the first representation of that whole mysticism, a really good representation of the whole, you know, the fights with the fight scenes and all that. So, but I don't know. What did you think, Engenbauer?
Yeah, I thought the fight scenes and everything in it were very well choreographed and everything. I forced myself to sit through this movie because of the subtitles. Mm. I watched it one time just to say that I watched it. I did like the choreographed stuff, like a lot of the bamboo stuff. That stuff was kind of cool, but for the most part, subtitles turned me off. It has been one of, I mean, nothing against the subtitle. I'm sure they have great movies, but I go to a movie to watch, not to read.
Oh, that's a valid point.
Well, there's plenty of visuals to take in with this movie.
Oh yeah, I agree. There was definitely a lot of visuals in that movie, but it's just one of those, like, ugh. After a while, I just get tired of seeing the subtitles across the bottom.
Yeah, you can, you know, and if you don't read quick enough, it can be frustrating. I will admit that, you know, sometimes depending on what they're trying to push. So, all right, Birchie, that brings us to you, sir, your number four pick.
My number four pick would be a very large contrast to my number five, going with the 2006 release of Little Miss Sunshine. I just preface this. Did anybody else out of our group see this at all?
I actually went to the critic screening to it in 2006.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a great ensemble cast. Movie written by Michael Arndt. This is another one that's just kind of stuck with me over the years. If you want to see dysfunctional with a capital D, this is definitely a movie to see. The general premise of the movie, if you haven't seen it, is a family goes cross country to get their daughter into a pageant, little kids pageant, and basically it's the premise of them getting from point A to point B to get her there. And just a lot of great performances. Greg Kinnear, Tony Collette, Steve Carell. Steve Carell's character is absolutely hilarious in this movie. Alan Arkin has a great performance. And I believe, John, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think this may have been Abigail Breslin's first movie. Is that correct?
Actually, that would be M. Night Shyamalan's Signs in 2002.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that, which is not on my list anywhere.
I don't think so. Nor mine.
But
what?
No.
What brilliant alien species comes down to a world that is 3/5 water and they can't tolerate water themselves? But go on.
But Little Miss Sunshine, if you haven't had the opportunity to see this, it's a very, very, I guess you could say, not necessarily a coming-of-age movie, but more so along the lines of what you would do for your family, as dysfunctional as they may be, to make somebody happy. I guess that's the best way I can phrase it.
It's watching it is almost like, you know, how much do you go against your family or try to, you know, mold them or shape them and then realize just, you know what, maybe they aren't as bad as everything else in the world.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Interesting. I have not seen this one. You guys have piqued my curiosity, though, a little bit. I will say that.
I tell you what, I haven't seen it either. So, Birchie, if you see The Dark Knight, I'll see Little Miss Sunshine.
Yes. The Dark Knight needs to be. I have all of these movies that are on this list, by the way.
Are they on, I'm wondering if any of these are on Netflix at all.
That might be.
Yeah, I might have to check them out.
The problem with Netflix, they rotate so much stuff in and out, it's hard.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's why I have the library I have.
Okay, so I guess that brings that to me. And we're on to number threes now, by the way. So for my number three pick, I had to throw Star Wars in there somewhere, of course, and I took Star Wars Revenge of the Sith.
No!
Yes.
I hate the sand.
I understand it's a prequel movie. I understand that there's a lot of prequel haters out there. I'm a prequel defender. This movie is the best of the prequels by far. This is what everybody's been waiting for. In the whole prequel thing is you finally get to see Anakin Skywalker put on the suit and become Darth Vader after being mangled to death, you know, by Obi-Wan Kenobi. Definitely the best lightsaber fight of all, in my opinion, was in Revenge of the Sith. Some people like Phantom Menace is better. I preferred this one. Overall, I thought the story was a lot stronger than the other two prequel movies. The only thing I will say that I didn't care for too much was Anakin's turn to the dark side. I thought it was a little bit on the weak side. I understand why they did it the way they did it, but I always kind of envisioned it a little differently, I guess. So, but other than that, I really enjoyed this movie. A lot of special effects. The opening scene is probably will take you back to the original Star Wars more than anything. Just from the music to the entire space battle kind of takes you back. So,
yeah, I'll agree with you. I'll agree with you. Of the three, I think this was probably the best.
And you know, and like you said, you know, there are those that will trash the prequels, and there are those that defend the prequels. And I think it should be noted that even for all three, there are stuff that should be defended. I mean, I actually think that the lightsaber battles in all three movies actually surpass the lightsaber battles in the original trilogy. I mean, because you finally have more polished fight scenes, you have a lot more better choreographing, and and on top of it, I mean, just the gravitas and just all the weight that's behind, you know, Obi-Wan and Anakin's battle at the end is just, it's easy to get lost in the intensity of it. It's like you said, it's what we really wanted to see.
Yeah. I mean,
I will say out of the three, this is the one, this did make my short list of my top 20 or 30 movies of the past 15 years. I can agree, Brink, it did have some selling points, if you want to call it that, you know, the lightsaber scenes, and just overall a nice wrap up to the prequel trilogy, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, it does a good job of.
There are things it did right. Finally,
yeah. If you know, you see the end of three, then you can obviously pick right back up with A New Hope if you were going to watch them chronologically. Thank you, and still be able to follow along and not miss a beat. So they did a real good job with the transition, and they're doing an even better job with Rebels, by the way, if just a little plug. So from a galaxy far, far away, we're over to John with a
very nearby galaxy back in Gotham, by the way. And going on to that is my choice for number three is The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's masterpiece, which where to begin with this movie? The movie came out at a time that literally had everybody up in arms about wiretapping, how far is too far to defend ourselves against terrorism, and then here comes a movie that we're like, oh, hey, let's go see a summer film, a good comic book film, and then we get this musings about how far is too far to combat an evil we don't understand, or we can't rationalize, or we can't reason with. And that is perfectly embodied by Heath Ledger and the Joker. I mean, it is a performance for the ages. I mean, had he lived, and there was just no competition for him for Best Supporting Actor that year. I mean, that year or any year, he changed how villains in movies are seen with that one performance. And I think this also might pique your curiosity, Bershi, the opening bank robbery scene, Nolan actually said he wanted to use heat as a visual motif for. So, and the entire thing was shot in IMAX cameras, meaning all the dialogue had to be re-recorded afterwards because of those gigantic 100-pound cameras that they couldn't capture the audio perfectly on. So the movie is a technical masterpiece. The movie is a brilliant metaphor for how far is too far to fight a terrorism. The movie, it just goes above and beyond. And even, I think the fourth time I went to see it in the theater with, I think the third or fourth week, still packed with giant audiences. I remember going to the bathroom afterwards, and there was this kid, could have been any more than like 6 or 7 years old, talking with his dad, asking him about the ending. And the end, and it's not just like an ending, like, why did this happen? But it was a, what does it mean to be a hero? What is it, I mean, why is he the hero and not this person? And it's just, it's the fact that it gets kids wondering the complexities of right and wrong. I mean, this is a movie that goes well above what a blockbuster should do, and it becomes something transcendent, and it truly was a movie that deserved every dollar it made and every bit of the reputation it had. The Dark Knight is a tentpole movie for our generation, and it's one of the best movies I've seen.
You definitely can't take anything away from Keith Ledger's performance as the Joker. I've had people, you know, there's a debate out there on the internet who was better, Nicholson or
Ledger.
And I think it's apples and oranges myself, but...
He's above Cesar Romero, too, I believe.
Well, everybody's above, yeah, as much as I love Cesar Romero.
The guy couldn't even, like, shave his mustache to go into the makeup.
But he did have a good laugh for the Joker.
He did agree. So does Mark Hamill.
Yeah, Mark Hamill has an even better one. He may have the best laugh of
he
all.
He may have the best laugh.
Yeah, but, absolute great performance by Heath Ledger, and I thought the internet did well when they said, well, what would Jack Nicholson say about Keith Ledger? He said, I'm glad you're dead. So, anyway.
I'm glad you're dead.
Anyway, so, I don't know. Eckebauer, what did you think? I know this was your trilogy, and now we're highlighting what John thinks is the masterpiece of that trilogy. So, what do you think? What are your
thoughts? That was my number four, was the entire trilogy. If I had to pick one of the three, this would definitely been the one that I picked that had been my favorite. But like I said, I wish he had died so we could have seen him in the third one, because I think having him in there would have been just amazing.
It truly shows the dedication an actor had to a role and just how much he dove into this persona. And it's creepy. I mean, there was a video I saw that somebody said was like the most intense moment was just that video camera scene, and then it cuts away and it's like this quiet, like, helicopter shot over the skyscape, and he said you could have heard a pin drop because people were just shocked.
Excellent movie, excellent trilogy, and from one great director to another. Brian, why don't you tell us what your number three pick was?
Number three on my list. I know some people might kind of, maybe kind of wince maybe a little bit. I don't know, because it's one of the biggest grossing movies of all time. Avatar, James Cameron's quote-unquote masterpiece. If you know anything about James Cameron, he created the Terminator, he did Titanic, he gave us Avatar. Simply put, if there's anything that James Cameron will do to create something in his movie, he will create it and bring it to life. And seeing Avatar in the theater, I saw it in 3D with my wife, just completely mind blown. The artistic merit of the movie, just the lush coloring. And he's had so many people that he's worked with over the years, Sigourney Weaver playing a bit part in the movie, a lot of other people involved with it that he's had in other films. Just an absolutely gorgeous movie. And the technology that Cameron has done to create some of his other movies, like I mentioned, if the technology is not there, he will create it. Going back to one of his earlier films from 1989 titled The Abyss, he shot that in an underwater abandoned nuclear reactor in North Carolina. Created a lot of the just a lot of the technology that wasn't there. And it's the same thing we've seen with Avatar. Created this whole lush landscape where the Na'vi live, created this whole language that they speak. Had some inspiration from Roger Dean, who many of you may or may not be familiar with. Roger Dean being an artist known most notably for creating a lot of the covers for Yes's albums, the progressive rock music group of Yes, and a lot of inspiration came from Roger Dean's artwork. A visual feast for the eyes is the best way I can describe it. That's kind of why it stuck with me. He's had a lot of the same people work with him over the years. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the second and third chapters of Avatar, if and when they come out.
Yeah, I got to admit this. I compared this movie almost to a Star Wars type of movie because it was groundbreaking. I mean, mm-hmm. as far as the motion capture, I believe that's the
word. Yeah, motion capture, the 3D cameras that didn't exist before.
Right, all the technology. It was really very much a George Lucas kind of move, inventing the technology and bringing that, you know, putting the actor in, basically creating something out of nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I'll
say this. I mean, Cameron is the Cecil B. DeMille of this generation. He is the man that will make going to the movies an event. Like, there are people that will say, oh, I'll wait to see it at home. I'll wait to see it in my theater. Oh, I've got a nice 70-inch 4K Ultra HD surround sound 7.1 at home. Cameron's the kind of director that those people will shut up and pay them the money to see them in the theater.
Oh yeah, he definitely creates a world that didn't exist before, and makes it feel like it's realistic, like it's actually out there. That was one of my favorite things about Avatar, and it was one of the hardest things for me to do was to take it off of my list.
For me, it was a little easy ever since I broke the script down, but the visual appeal I can't deny. It's one of the most visually arresting movies of this generation.
I mean,
ever since the 3D explosion, it's the best 3D use out there. One of the best 3D uses.
I will say that granted, I wasn't going to make this comparison, but it just kind of came up and popped into my head. Now, if you want to compare a good director to a bad director, let's compare James Cameron to Michael Bay. Because at least with James Cameron's movies, if he's got an explosion, there's a reason why it's in the explosion. There's a reason why it's in the movie.
You know, it's funny, that's the other thing, too, is ever since I watched Armageddon and Pearl Harbor, going to see it in the theater, I always felt Bay wanted to make the next Titanic with both of those movies.
Probably. Although the two, Armageddon was better, but
well,
Pearl Harbor was just a piece of crap.
Pearl Harbor still sits as my worst movie of all time, and I've seen every Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode known to man.
Pearl Harbor is the reason why I'm really worried about Ben Affleck as Batman, but that's beside the point. all right, Brian Akenbauer, I think it's time for your number three pick, sir.
Oh, yeah, my number three. It's like John's number five. John's number five. It is a movie from this year. Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Much like Fury Road, it was action-packed from start to finish. Tom Cruise has always been a favorite of mine because, like John said, he does too whatever the audience will, whatever he thinks is going to sell an audience on making a movie. That's what he does.
Not War of the Worlds.
I mean, even still, he did a fantastic job in this movie. All the supporting cast did a tremendous job in this movie. The car chase / motorcycle chase, oh dear lord, it's going to be a top five. I think everybody needs to see this movie.
It's definitely on my high ups list to see.
Oh my gosh, it was after seeing the movie, it was just like one of those, I can't wait for the next one. I realize there's been how many of them, like five or six of them.
Five.
The fifth one, yes.
Right, and I'm like, I'm still like, okay, when's the next one coming? That's how good this movie was.
By the fourth film, the movie realized, the series realized exactly where it needed to go, because I think Ghost Protocol is one of the finest action movies of the past 15, 20 years as well. And that's the movie that said, you know what, this is where we need to take the series. This is what we need to let Cruise do. This is how we need to let the cast interact. This is how we need to let the action sequences play out. I mean, that's, like I said, I need to see it, but if it lives up to Ghost Protocol, then it, Ghost Protocol really set the tone for me. That would be one of my runners-up, is Ghost Protocol.
And again, I think, and not to go back to the Bourne thing, but yeah, I think Bourne changed everything.
It did.
For the spy genre. I think after that, you got Skyfall and you got Ghost Protocol.
Right.
Which were all reaction.
Right.
You know?
And it left Mission Impossible 2 and 3 by the wayside, rightfully so.
Yeah, it did. And I enjoyed both 1 and 2, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, one's amazing.
Yeah, but so Okay, gentlemen, we are up to our number twos. And, John, I think you're up first with your number two pick.
My number two pick, and going off of Bershi's 3D visceral experience of Avatar, I'm going to go with a movie that has a very personal connection to me, and that is Martin Scorsese's 2011 film Hugo. Adapted from the novel The Invention of Hugo Cabret, the movie is... God, where to begin? The movie is basically Martin Scorsese's love letter to all movies. This is the movie that he basically says, if, you know, I guess the best way I can describe this movie is like the mindset I was in at the time that I saw it. A week before I saw that movie, I was looking back on where I was. I'd turned 30, and I was like, you know what? I'm not where I wanted to be in life. Nothing's going where I wanted to be. I'm barely bringing anything in. I was going through the deepest existential crisis I could possibly go through with that movie. Or not with that movie, but just with my life. And I literally packed up my entire editing bay, all of my filmmaking equipment, my camera, my books, all of the tools I'd collected, and I was just like, you know what? I need to go back for like a master's in business. I need to have like something. I'm married now. I need to start a family. I need to do something. And I had hit the rock bottom of my life. And then my wife says, hey, you know what? Let's go to the movies. And she takes me to see Hugo. It's the opening weekend. I'm like, oh, hey, I got to check this out. And, of course, I want to see it in 3D because it's Martin Scorsese taking on 3D. So it's like, oh, wow, I got to see what he does with it. And I not only got one of the greatest, I'm going to say the greatest 3D experience I ever had in my life, but also the message of the movie hit so close to home. The story about Ben Kingsley saying, or when you realize who Ben Kingsley's character is, you realize what he made, all those films that he made in the past, and that he had to give it all up and basically just become a broken toy repairman in a train station, and just what the whole movie meant to not live up to your potential, and that a machine that's not working isn't living up to its purpose, and just every bit of that movie is poetry. I still watch it to this day. I still go back and remind myself. And I actually had a kind of surreal moment where I actually got to work on the Miles Davis movie last year with Don Cheadle and Ewan McGregor and Michael Stuhlbarg, who is also in Hugo. And I actually got the chance, like during a very big lull, to build up the courage and go up to Mr. Stuhlbarg and tell him, you know what, I just have to tell you my story. And I told him the story, and he was just so floored by it. He was just said, you know what, just thank you for that. And I just like, I just need to know, what was it like being on that set? And he said, I'm still coming down from the high. Every bit of that movie was just magic. It's like, maybe next year I'll go back and I'll watch it again, but I still feel the high from being on the set of that film. Hugo is pure magic. Hugo saved me. Hugo made me unpack all those boxes, get my editing system back out, get my camera back out, get my books out, and I am where I am today because of Hugo. And not only is it one of the most perfect movies ever made, but it literally is the movie that saved me.
I'm not sure I can add anything more to that other than I may have to go watch Hugo now.
Oh, yeah, I would say I've never seen Hugo, but I want saving too, so I might have to go see it.
There you go. Nothing. I can't really add anything more than that. That was quite the soliloquy.
I can say, John, I did see Hugo, although I'm still kicking myself to this day that I didn't see it in the theater, and I didn't see it in 3D either.
That, don't feel bad. Apparently it's box office proved you weren't the only one.
Yeah, and I can agree with your sentiments. I mean, it's a very, for conversational purposes, I'll throw this out there because I know a lot of us know Scorsese as being a very gritty, a very dirty director, if you want to phrase it that way. He's known for, you know, doing a lot of gangster type movies, and to see him do a movie in this way, from this perspective, I thought was a very, very... I'm trying to figure out the best phrasing for it.
That's exactly the sentiments I thought, too. Is like it's him stepping out of his comfort zone. And to see a director step out of their comfort zone, what they're familiar with, whether it's Scorsese doing period pieces or crime films, he has never done a family film before. And most directors, if they step out of what they're familiar with, they fail. But Scorsese managed to make one of the greatest family movies of all time that honestly deserves to be mentioned in the same breath of Mary Poppins and Wizard of Oz.
I have no arguments there.
I think that covers it, fellas. And Bertie, I think your number two's up next. And I never saw the movie, but I definitely love the soundtrack. I'll tell you that. Go ahead, sir.
We're speaking of my number two, which would be Requiem for a Dream.
Yes, sir.
Wow. All I can say is just it's a Darren Aronofsky film. If you've seen any of Darren Aronofsky's work, most notably he's known for recently, I guess you could say, Black Swan.
And Noah. Which,
here's the thing. I'm thinking of Black Swan. I'm thinking because Black Swan was on my short list as well.
Might as well.
Requiem for a Dream, if you've not seen it, a great, excellent supporting cast, including Jennifer Connelly, Ellen Burstyn, just an extremely heavy, 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 I cannot emphasize it, heavy, heavy movie. I mean, this is one of those movies that you will go into watching it, you will come out movie drunk. But the message that is there, to me, is still stuck with me to this day. But it's one of those movies where after I watched it, it was kind of like, I want to watch it again, but I don't know if I can watch it again because of the depiction of how somebody can go into a downward spiral of drug addiction in a film. Just unbelievable.
That was one of the most memorable theatrical experiences I had. I actually did see it in the theater twice, and each time it's... Now, it should be noted that the time that I got to see it in the theater, it was actually at the Esquire, because the movie is rated NC-17. The movie is not given an R rating, and Aronofsky refused to cut it to keep all of the graphicness in the film, and rightfully so, because that last half hour is one of the most intense experiences you will have in the cinema.
Brutal.
Because it's intense, and that's just the best way to put it. And there's few movies out there that you watch and you don't want to see again. You admire it, you're like, I love it, don't ever show it to me again. I had that experience watching Schindler's List, I had that experience watching United 93, and I had that experience watching Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm. And I'll also say this, also co-stars one of the Wayans brothers, and if you're familiar with the Wayans brothers, they're most notably known for comedy, but Marlon Wayans in this movie is just
100%
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Jared Leto's performance, I mean, Christopher McDonald, just a whole slew of another great ensemble cast in this movie.
But definitely sounds like it matches the soundtrack, so that's all I can speak for. The soundtrack is like the ultimate destruction. If you're talking about epic destruction, that's exactly what it sounds like. So it sounds like it matches your guys' descriptions to me on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So from one kind of destruction to another, Brian Inkenbauer, your number two pick, sir.
My number two pick was Captain America, Winter Soldier. seen it numerous times. It is one of my favorite superhero movies. Mm. It's another one of the ones that if it's on TV, I'll watch it.
Definitely. It's a great Phase 2 setup movie.
It's been playing a lot on Stars here, and every time it's on, my wife and I just leave it on because it's so fun.
Yeah, it is. It's just a fun movie.
It definitely is. I mean, we've been saying it for a while now, but a lot of the Marvel movies have started to become... They're so intertwined anymore, and you see so many hints of the other movies in there, of stuff to come. It's I don't know. I enjoy it. I enjoy a lot of superhero movies. That's why it's so high on my list.
Well, not only that, I mean, I think, I'll say it, I think Winter Soldier and Dark Knight need to be mentioned in the same sentence, because I think with Dark Knight coming out around the same time that wiretaps were a controversial issue, Winter Soldier came out around the same time that online profiling was a really big thing, and drone strikes, and every bit of that is like, this is like, oh, hey, 2 weeks ago, this is like a major headline, and I'm watching this, these plot lines in a Marvel film again on the big screen. I'm just like, you're just going above and beyond what is supposed to be a popcorn film and becoming a biting commentary on society.
Yeah, and real reflection on the day and the age.
It's, right? Yeah, it's just Winter Soldier definitely is a movie that should not be looked over, because it's the kind of movie that you don't call a comic book film. It's the kind of movie you call a graphic novel.
It is.
Novelization.
And it's pivotal to the storytelling of the whole cinematic universe, too. I mean, it's a really great setup movie for Avengers, and stands perfectly fine on its own as well. So,
yep.
It could be the best Marvel standalone film next to Iron Man. I mean, actually over Iron Man. It's the best standalone Marvel cinematic film.
I would say so far, yeah. Everything I've seen so far. Yeah. I haven't seen Ant-Man yet, but I would definitely say by far.
Oh, yeah, Captain America definitely beats out Ant-Man.
Poor Paul Rudd.
Well, speaking of the little guy against the big world, my number two pick was the movie Moneyball. This is kind of like Engelbauer just said, this is a movie that if it's on, I watch it regardless, and I love watching it every time. And I don't know if it's a reflection of because we're from the Cincinnati area and the Cincinnati market and the Reds baseball team, Cincinnati Reds, are a small market team, and we're always being robbed of our good players because we can't afford to keep them in. And I don't know if that's part of it or if it's Brad Pitt's performance, which is outstanding.
It's his best. I think it's his best.
It's just an absolutely outstanding movie and a sports movie. If you like baseball at all, anyway, even if you don't, you're going to love this movie.
I got to agree with you on there. I went into the movie. I was not a baseball fan. I mean, I don't know one player from another. I don't know any about the history or any of the stats. But when Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill are on a telephone talking about trading players to other teams, I am on the edge of my seat, and it's just the script. I think that's the other thing that needs to be noted, too. The Aaron Sorkin screenplay, and also Aaron Sorkin, Stephen Zalian, I can't remember the third writer off the top of my head right now, but they are some of the best writers working in Hollywood right now, and what they brought to the table with that movie is this wonderful, wonderful story about adapting with the times. And not only adapting with the times, but just, it's like the Brad Pitt line in there says, how can you not be romantic about baseball?
Exactly. And Jonah Hill, just to touch on Jonah Hill, great performance. Probably his best performance I've ever seen.
His first Oscar nomination, too.
Yeah, I mean, just outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. Just the geekiness, everything. He just captures all of it, man.
Dear God, this is Jonah Hill for Moneyball.
Right. One claim to fame, right? But, yeah, I mean, it's just outstanding movie from beginning to end. Like I said, anytime it's on, I don't care what part, if it's right in the middle, right at the end, right at the beginning, I will sit there and I'll leave it on and I'll watch all of it.
You know, fittingly enough, it came out the same year as Hugo, and Moneyball was second on my list to Hugo.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, just a great movie overall. Feel good, too. I mean,
I'll say it was on my short list as well, and I'm not a big Brad Pitt fan by any stretch of the imagination, but it was one of those movies where it was like, oh, hey, let's watch this, and it was like Moneyball. I was like, baseball drama? Jonah Hill? What are you talking about? But I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, it's probably one of those ones, like you said, Brink, you know, if it was on, I would probably sit and watch it.
Yeah, it has been on. TBS loves to play the damn thing for some reason, or FX does, and I sit there and I'll just watch it. They got me hooked. I'll sit there and watch it all the time. All right, gentlemen, so we are down to the number ones. So, Bertie, you have the honor, sir.
Oh, I get to go first?
You get to go first. You're the first of the first.
All right, so let's preface this here. I'll just ask the group now. John, you can't answer, so I'm asking this towards Brink and Ankenbauer. But have you seen any David Lynch movies?
If I have, I'm not aware. I'll tell you.
Okay. I'm in the same boat as Brink.
All right.
I've seen Elephant Man.
I've seen Dune. There we go. Okay. The original Dune, right?
Yes, day before.
Yeah.
So my number one movie, and I had a tough time picking out a favorite because I kept going back and forth between Mulholland Drive and Memento. It was very, very difficult for me to go back and forth between both of those and pick one that I really enjoyed. Now, Mulholland Drive is David Lynch's masterpiece. I mean, it's just one of those movies you go in and after you watch it, you're just like, what the fuck did I just watch? Because it's so fucking twisted. Pardon my French, but that's the best way to phrase it. It's got just all these folks that he's worked with in all of his other movies. If you've ever seen Twin Peaks, you know, some of the same actors and actresses are working with him again in this. But it's just the general premise of this actress played by, what's her name? Her name is
Naomi Watts.
She plays this actress, and it's like her trying to find herself is how I'm interpreting it. But even Lynch has stated himself that I'm not going to give a general premise of what this movie is about, leaving it to your own interpretation of what the movie is about, because there are still things that after I've seen the movie probably about six times, and there's still things that I think about in this movie saying, how is this part connected to this part, and what the hell does this mean? It's just one of those movies where it's a great visual feast for the eyes, storyline wise and action wise, but at the end you're just sitting there thinking, what the fuck did I just watch?
So it was the qua moment? Is that what you're saying?
I'll say this about, was it 2001? You know, you mentioned Memento, and you mentioned that. I also think we've got to mention the other mindfuck movie of 2001, Vanilla Sky, which was a great, great mind twist. With that year alone, you had the kind of mindfuck that would take you out to dinner at a five-star restaurant and then put you up at a quality hotel for the night and make sure that you had your, you know, continental breakfast paid for the next morning.
Yeah.
That's the kind of ride you're in for with these movies. I actually remember seeing Mulholland Drive in the theater. We drove to this like Danbury Cinema, like in the middle of nowhere. We were like taking left turn through neighborhood and right turn. We were just like, where the hell are we going? And then we get to this like literally in the middle of nowhere theater, and we go to see it. And it could have been the most perfect way to see that film, because it's like you're taking all these turns. You get to the movie and you sit down and you watch it. And I remember looking at my girlfriend at the time, and we just looked at each other and we just went, I like it. I don't know why.
Yeah.
And I remember I worked at the video store that year, and when it came out for rental, it actually has, on the inside sleeve of the DVD, has 10 secrets to unlocking the clues of Mulholland Drive, and we sat there with it in front of us, notebooks in hand, writing down each of the clues, and by the end we just kind of sat and talked to each other and just went, oh, wow, that was a ride.
And that's the thing, too, it's with David Lynch's creations. You know, if you've, I've seen some of his other movies, I think it's Lost Highway, which is another mind trip. And
Eraserhead,
Mulholland Drive. We've got, what's his other big one that he had?
Inland Empire.
And there was another one that he did too, which is eluding me at the moment.
Elephant Man. Wild at Heart. You want me to go on?
Blue Velvet.
Yes.
If you haven't seen Blue Velvet, that's another great one from the 80s. He's so far out there in left field, but he's so brilliant at what he does that when he puts something together and you watch it, you're just, what did I watch? But it's so beautiful that you can't even put it into words.
It sounds like if I want a mind trip, this is the movie to see.
Oh, yeah, but most definitely. If not for the visuals, Naomi Watts' performance in the movie is just absolutely beautiful.
I think the major selling point, which is the reason the DVD doesn't have any chapter breaks on it, which is the fact that there is a beautiful little romantic scene between Naomi Watts and her companion in the film.
Oh, yeah?
Which is quite possibly one of the steamiest scenes in film history, probably up there with any Kate Winslet scene in Little Children.
So it's a pass out the...
It's a bring your raincoat.
Yeah. And then bring a nice wet nap to clean yourself up with afterwards, right? All right. So, on that note, that brings me to my number one pick. And my number one pick is The Departed. I don't even know where to start with this. I love this movie from the beginning with the soundtrack. The soundtrack of the movie is awesome. It's your ultimate crime drama movie. It's suspense thriller. Jack Nicholson, Leonardo DiCaprio,
Mark Wahlberg
is even good in it. Matt Damon is in it.
Alec
Baldwin is
Martin
in it.
Sheen.
Martin Sheen. Thank you. And just an all-star ensemble, and it really shows. And I'm a big Jack Nicholson fan, and this is probably some of his best work. He's not the main character. I mean, he kind of is, but he's not. He's definitely a supporting character. So, love this movie. This is not a movie you want to watch with your family, per se. but it is it's a damn good movie. And that's why it's my number one. So, that's about all I have to say on it.
This movie reminded me a lot of Goodfellas.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? The Departed. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, The Departed, I'll be honest, I thought there was like the Miramax time when Harvey Weinstein stated, I'm going to get Martin Scorsese his Oscar, and sunk God knows how much money into Gangs of New York and The Aviator, and those movies are just such bloated, like, lost films that I could not get into. And then he gets back to his roots, like going back to the crime dramas, going back to The Taxi Driver, The Goodfellas, like just going back to those good, gritty Mean Streets crime drama with the Departed, and I couldn't have been happier. That was one of the most satisfying theatrical experiences I had that year. It was so much fun, so intense, so clever. It just took so many crazy turns. I mean, the end comes around, you just have no idea who's left. It's so nuts.
And the rat with blood is perfect.
Right, and just, and again, it's the movie that got Martin Scorsese his long-deserved Oscar, which I'm so glad it was for a crime drama as opposed to one of those other, like, costume flicks.
Right, exactly. So, very well done. All right, so that brings us to, this is going to be a duel, last number one pick between Mr. Enkenbauer and John.
We have a coinciding choice for number one on our list. Enkenbauer and I both have chosen the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I can look at The Dark Knight separate from The Dark Knight trilogy. I can look at The Bourne Identity separate from The Bourne trilogy, and I can look at so many trilogies separate, but I cannot look at the Lord of the Rings movies as being separate, because he went in not saying, I'm going to film Fellowship of the Ring this year and Two Towers the next year. He went in for 13 to 15 months and shot the entire trilogy. He took every actor on that set and said, you are going to be here for this length of time. We need to make sure you're here for that. And it is one of... It goes back to the old, like the Ben-Hur, the Lawrence of Arabia age of what it meant to make a sprawling epic, to be that entrenched in detail and that vast in scope. And movies have not come out since then. It's the last great epic. The Lord of the Rings movies are just, seeing them in the theater was a mind-blowing experience. I mean, the work, the camera work they did, the angles, the movement, the use of effects. I mean, it was one of the early uses of motion capture with Andy Serkis's Gollum and the Two Towers. It sets a new standard for battle scenes. I mean, that battle scene in the Two Towers is one of the greatest. I mean, if you thought going to see Saving Private Ryan with Omaha Beach, you're like, I'm not going to see another great war scene there. 4 years later, we have a battle at Helm's Deep that lasts about 30, 40 minutes. It is so perfectly, perfectly built up, executed, set up. There's not a single dull moment or repetitive moment in those battle scenes. And just everything about it was just so pitch perfect, from the detail of what's on the walls to what the characters are wearing to the story. It's just, this is, you don't see that kind of filmmaking anymore. And just, it was, it's flawless. Hank?
Well, you nailed all the points I was going to talk about. It was by far the most impactful movie series that I saw so far this century, if you will. It definitely created a whole world. Knowing that it was books originally, it created a whole world of something that I felt it could have been realistic. You can tell, you know, with the orcs and everything else that it's not real. However, the way it was portrayed, you actually felt like it was actually, this could be happening over in Australia or somewhere, or Ireland, you know, wherever. It's just, it's one of those things like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I think between watching Lord of the Rings and Fury Road, it made me nostalgic and wanted to go back. I mean, just not nostalgic, but just, it just made me want to like go to New Zealand and say, hey, what are you guys doing movie-wise? How can I help?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was amazing.
Well, I think it was, they had a lot to live up to, too. I mean, for those who read the books beforehand.
Oh, right.
And, they that was a monumental task, and he delivered.
Right,
Peter,
I mean, Peter Jackson. I mean, that is one of the most beloved novels of all time.
Absolutely.
And the devoted fan base behind it. I mean, if they didn't do it right, there would have been riots in New Zealand, and...
I mean, there was, you know, graffiti written in, you know, subways for years that said Frodo lives. Nobody, hardly anybody knew who Frodo was unless you read the books, right? So, but yet there were the hardcore fans over the years, you know, and we're talking decades even, you know. So, and then they took the vast richness that was the books and took that material and were able to transpose it to the big screen, which I think is what made it special.
Yeah. And again, going to like the Cecil B. DeMille thing that was... Going to see Lord of the Rings in the theater, you couldn't wait for your big screen. That was a big screen event.
Yeah, is it better than Star Wars in my book? No, but I can see where people think that. You know, I'll give it that much credit. That's as far as I'll go. So,
Bertie, what do you think?
Honestly, it's another trilogy I haven't seen.
You watched the first and second one in the living room with me.
Yeah, and it just, they didn't do anything for me.
You watched the first one from what you said.
But I'll also go back to a phrase that Tolkien said himself before he passed away. He said there was not going to be any way possible that anybody could physically capture everything that is written in this book.
Well,
they did pretty damn close job.
But then again, look at how many versions of the movie were released. I think what was the honest trailer said, hey, look, it's a 6-hour version of people walking.
Well, yeah, that is.
There are two versions.
There is the whole Clerks 2 argument, which is pretty damn funny, by the way. But
which he's repeated in many stand-up routines.
Right. It's funny. But, I mean, what I liked about what they did with the special editions, if you will, to use that term loosely, is instead of having deleted scenes, they put them in there. So
it's part of the story.
It's part of the story.
And it actually defines, like, the story between Faramir and his brother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
I guess I can honestly say that whole realm of that whole fantasy realm of dragons and wizards and it's just never been my cup of tea.
I can understand that. I can appreciate that. You're right though. It was the basis for D&D and everything that came off.
And before the books even probably influenced Star Wars in some respect.
I would definitely say
because
so.
The books did come before the Star Wars movies.
There are some similarities that you can probably draw, and that might be a discussion for another show. So, all right, gentlemen, well, we've gotten through our top five, and real quickly, let's go through some honorable mentions. Some of them that didn't make our top five, but could have at some point. Mine was Guardians of the Galaxy, Inside Out, the Star Trek reboot, No Country for Old Men, Kill Bills Volume 1 and 2, Wally, Fight Club, Juno, and Idiocracy. Ankenbauer, what were yours?
I had a bunch on mine. I had a huge list. It was hard to pare it down just to five, but some of the ones made it to other people's top fives. like The Departed and Serenity and Skyfall. But some of my other ones were Edge of Tomorrow, Oblivion, Trouble with the Curve, 310 to Yuma, which I think is one of the best westerns that's come out in a long time.
Yes.
That's a remake, too.
Yes, yeah. It is. It's a great remake.
Guardians of the Galaxy was on my list and didn't make it. Bourne Anthology, Avatar.
As should also be noted, The Departed is actually a remake, too.
Yeah, it is from Japan, yeah.
Oh, it's China's Internal Affairs.
Yeah, it's a Japanese movie, actually.
I had some other ones that are more more or less guilty pleasures than they are runner-ups, but Green Lantern, King Kong, Iron Man movies, Spider-Man movies, and Runner-Runner. Uh-huh. Those are all the ones that are, if they're on TV, I'll sit and watch them.
Runner-Runner was actually halfway decent. Maybe a little hokey, but not much. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty good.
And I'll back you up on King Kong and actually the Iron Man movies. I don't think I have any flaws with the Iron Man films at all.
All right. And Birchie, your honorable mention, sir?
I had a couple honorable mentions. Like I said, creating this list was pretty tough for me.
Applaud you, though, sir. Well done. Well done for coming through.
I have a list of honorable mentions. I'll start off with a dark comedy that some of you may or may not have seen, but it's kind of one of those defining movies similar to what I mentioned earlier. Jack Black in the movie Bernie. If you haven't seen this movie, it's a dark comedy. He plays a funeral director. It's based off of a true story. Just a very, very dark, very different role for Jack Black to play. A very good movie that's kind of stuck with me over the years. I also would have put Up and Toy Story 3 on my list. Both very good animated flicks from Pixar and Disney. Yes. Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. I'm not a big fan of George Clooney's acting, but the storyline and premise of Gravity really kind of puts you out there in space. I would say I would put it on the same level as Apollo 13 from Ron Howard, although we're talking that's a different set of years, so to speak, but just the whole premise of being out in space and being nowhere to go kind of thing. Scanner Darkly, one of my favorites from Philip K. Dick, who's died too soon, a very prolific science fiction writer in the 50s, was most notably known for Blade Runner, but Scanner Darkly I thought was a visual feast for the eyes, and if you're a fan of Philip K. Dick's work, you've seen some of his other things, most notably probably Minority Report, a lot of people have seen. The Aviator, Memento, Sin City for its visuals, Black Swan, another Darren Aronofsky film, Big Fish, Giant Tearjerker, but a great story. Lost in Translation was another one that I really enjoyed from Sofia Coppola. High Fidelity did make my short list, although it didn't make my top five. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a great turn of acting for Jim Carrey, if you have not seen it. A great mind twist movie. Shutter Island, another great Scorsese flick. The Mist from Stephen King, and Cabin in the Woods from Josh Whedon.
My goodness, sir. Well, for somebody who was afraid he wouldn't be able to find the top five, you certainly did.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of gems that have come out.
All right,
no,
Johnny.
And the thing about it was that as I got, just real quick, as I went back through the list of movies that had come out since 2000, I was like, wow, this movie's like kind of stuck with me, and this movie kind of stuck with me. And it was after I got past that, and it was like, okay, now I've got a list of 20. I had a list of 32, and I pared it down to 5. So
yeah, that
sounds like it might have re-energized you towards movies, maybe a little bit too, there, sir. So
yeah, maybe a little bit.
There's always hope. There's always hope out there. Always, always look on the bright side. Indeed. Look for the silver lining.
Johnny, your honorable mentions.
All right. Going off of other people's lists that have made my honorable mentions, The Departed, Moneyball, and Requiem for a Dream are on my list. I also want to throw nods out there to Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men, some of the best use of one takes in a movie ever. Steven Spielberg's incredibly poetic and incredibly timely Munich, which I think always needs to be given like a good watch over every once in a while when looking at Middle Eastern relations. The Coen brothers' flawlessly made film, No Country for Old Men, which has absolutely no weak points whatsoever. Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, probably one of the most entertaining rides to come out in the summertime. It's so much fun. Another Ang Lee film is his 2012 Life of Pi, a movie that took 4 years to bring to the screen and was adapted from a novel that many people thought was unadaptable, and he brought one of the greatest visual experiences again. We mentioned it in the show before, Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. I also want to throw out there David Fincher's movie The Social Network.
I like that one.
Love that one. Danny Boyle's 127 Hours has a very, very personal connection with me. Not that I've lost any of my limbs, but that the movie, just the portrayal of the character and his need to do everything on his own, definitely hit very close to home for me. Christopher Nolan's Memento is another fantastic mind twist film. It's on my list of runner-ups. Another Steven Spielberg film is his overlooked film AI, a movie that I think needs to be given kind of the context to think that it was not just a Kubrick film made sentimental by Spielberg or a Spielberg film ruined by the coldness of Kubrick. I think it's a movie that was meant to be seen as it was a hybrid of the two, and it just needs to be seen in that respect. United 93, watch it once, be moved, and if you watch it more than once, I will wonder what is wrong with you, because I would never want to experience that more than once. Julian Schnabel's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly is a fantastically made movie from a longtime Steven Spielberg DP collaborator Janusz Kaminski, photographing a movie that for the first half is told from the perspective of a character's single eyeball, and you just get his perspective from just the one shot. The Iranian film A Separation is an amazing film that I had no clue what it was about, and was floored by where the story went from there. And I also want to conclude with my last runner-up, which is one of the most underrated comedies, and a movie that I think everybody should see, and that is Edgar Wright's Hot Fuzz. That is one of the finest send-ups to American cop dramas of all time, and it's just everything in that is perfect.
Indeed. All right, gentlemen, well, I guess the only thing we have left to do is time for final thoughts. Okay, Birchie, I'll give you the honor of first final thought.
I get the first final thought again?
Yes, sir.
What's going on here? I will
You're
say...
the most long-winded. No, I'm kidding.
I thought that was Z. no, I'll say in my final thought, I guess I'll say that, you know, looking back through this list of movies, things that have come out since 2000, it made me kind of look back through some of the movies that I enjoyed and some of the movies that I'd forgotten about. It's obviously, I know you guys kind of gave me some crap about trying to come up with a list, but I think it's one of those things where I'm probably going to wind up going back through and probably, you know, over the next couple of months, probably watching some of these that I haven't watched in a while, or maybe see something that I haven't seen before. Who knows? We'll see.
Honestly, that was kind of what I've always hoped for.
I'm having a heart attack. Oh, my God. All right. I never thought you would say that, man. That's awesome. Right. I'm over here, like, trying to do, like, doing the whole super fans thing and smacking my chest. All right.
King Kong telling me it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Brian Eckenbauer, your final thoughts, sir?
My final thoughts are, you know, as long as movies keep, you know, bringing stuff, making it feel realistic,
even if it's from a galaxy far away or a city close, you know, like New York or Gotham or whatever. The reason why I go to the movies is to escape the everyday, so I'm hoping to see more of those in the days, weeks, and months and years to come. So I'm hoping that I'll have much more to add to the list.
Excellent, sir. Excellent. My final thought, you know, movies are kind of gateways. They take us, like you said, from a galaxy far, far away, all the way to the windows of our souls. They take us, they move us, they open our eyes, take us to places that we've never seen. They make you look at yourself in a new way, in a different way, maybe even. And I think it's because of those gateways that we continue to see movies, and I think that's why a lot of these movies we talked about today were like that. And I'm hoping that the future continues to go that way. So that's my final thought. And we'll now end the final thought with the guy who decided that this was his baby, his idea for the show, Mr. John Z. Your final thought, sir.
You know, Bergie, I think you summed it up perfectly. That's exactly what I was hoping for with this, is that, you know, you go back and look at everything that's new and realize that there's stuff, there's new trends being set, there's new paths being forged, there's new stuff that's being made in films. But, and like all new things, I mean, they're definitely scary things to venture into. Like when Citizen Kane at the first time opened up in 1941 saying that their main character's first shot was going to be dead. That was completely revolutionary for its time, and trends have been changed ever since. And while we can nostalgically look back on films and we can admire the classics and appreciate what is new, it's just there's always something that will come along that's new and set the new standard, and that's the stuff that does need to be seen and seen embraced. And, you know, there will always be, there's always going to be your sequelitis, there's always going to be your bland stuff that comes out, there's always going to be stuff that never impacts, but the thing that's going to last, no one's going to remember the crappy movie they saw, but they're always going to remember the good thing that they saw in the theater, the good time they had. And that is what I think this list is supposed to, what I wanted to hope, what the most hope I had for this list, which was that we'd all see what in us made the biggest impact and see where it goes another 15 years from now and see what influences it and where it goes from there.
Indeed, indeed. Hear, 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 hear. I think it's been an excellent show, gentlemen. If you guys want to reach back out to us, where you can find us, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/4MidwestGuys. You can find us on Twitter at @4MidwestGuys. You can also reach us via email at 4MidwestGuys@gmail.com. It's been an excellent show, gentlemen. I loved it. Loved every minute of it. For John Z, for Brian B, and for Eckenbauer, I'm B. Willie, and I like banana smoothies. That's for you, Brian Eckenbauer. Change my shirt. Peace.